Well, thank you very much for the special music. I appreciated that. I enjoy Bach. He's a pretty amazing composer in my mind anyway. But so thank you, and greetings to everybody in the room. Now that I look back, I see we have a lot more people in here than I was expecting, I guess. I couldn't see you all from where I was sitting. But anyway, it's great to be here. I always enjoy coming. It was a nice day to travel, and just good to be here. Well, I don't know if you watch the daily news or read about it or hear about it. It seems to be pretty repetitively tragic. You can turn on the TV, watch the local news, and see about the latest shooting, the latest flooding, the latest heat, the latest fires, the latest tornado, the latest rioting, and the list goes on and on. So many tragedies going on in this world today. And each one of these instances involves a tragedy for one person or many. And each one of these affects families, neighborhoods, businesses, schools, and other facets of life. And in each case, we hear and see the tragic losses suffered by one or more people. We see and hear the stories of those directly suffering losses, those who are quick to respond and provide help in many different ways. We regard them as heroes, and they certainly are. And we see and hear about some of the long-term effects for individuals. And then the news goes on to the next story. The traffic reports, the weather, sports, and other things to take our minds off this main breaking news. And we quickly lose track of the individuals involved. They are most likely people we don't know and never will know, and our minds just don't retain all that. There are other people. But God knows every one of these other people. He knows their lives and their families and their problems and triumphs, their hopes and plans, and the time will come when every one of these individuals will learn about God's plan for all of mankind, and they will be able to take steps to follow him. But not yet. There are no other people with God. He knows and loves them all and will work with them in his own way, in his own time. And the title of this message is God's Other People, with the word other in quotation marks. God's Other People. And it refers to the millions and billions of others outside the comprehension of our own individual lives and minds. There are billions of people out there, and to us they're all other people, people we won't know in this lifetime. Our human minds tend to get bogged down when you try to understand other people's situations. News reports may show them standing in the spot where their home once stood, trying to comprehend what happened. No amount of comforting, though, from others can compensate for their losses. With few exceptions, most of us in the room here don't know the people involved, unless we've been in the affected area or experienced something similar. It's really hard to understand what they're going through. I've got 3 points or 3 thoughts in this message. The first is the thought, our own thoughts about other people. The book of Galatians talks about what kind of attitude we should have toward others. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 2 says, "Brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. So we're told that we shouldn't forget about these people. We should in some way be bearing one another's burdens. It's a command to bear others' burdens, but generally we're not in a position to directly do that. These are other people, distant location. Down in verses 9 and 10, we're told to do good to all, even to other people. And let's continue. Galatians chapter 6. Continue on in verse 3. For if anyone thinks himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. But let each one examine his own work, and then he will have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another. For each one shall bear his own load. And verse 6, let him who is taught the word share in all good things with him who teaches. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. But he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. Verse 9, and let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. So we're told to not grow weary while doing good. Keep it up. Don't give up. Remember the problems of others as we can. So I try to imagine myself in whatever situation is being described, and their experience is something that just wouldn't and doesn't sink in right away. First thing I would see is the physical damages and try to comprehend that. And in some ways, that's the easy part of it to look at. The physical side is sometimes easier to deal with than the emotional side. But given the resources, both financial and physical, much of the physical problems or physical property could be rebuilt or restored. What would I think about if I were in a situation like that? Well, first, I like to think that I would be grateful that my physical life was spared, along with the lives of friends and neighbors. And next, I think about all the little things that may be very simple and inexpensive, but they carry meaning and memories that are lost and cannot be passed down to others. I think of things such as their personal photos that help document their lives. In my own case, I've scanned all of our family photos, so I have digital copies of everything. So I scan the physical photos, the slides, the negatives, anything I can find from my own family and some of my ancestors, the photos that have been passed down. As long as the scans are still accessible, now most of those images could be reproduced, but there's something special about the original photos. Just imagining that they were handled and viewed by my parents and grandparents, maybe great-grandparents and others who were alive at the time the photos were taken. They knew the history of the occasion. I think of some photos in particular. There's a photo that I have hanging on the wall at home. It's of my grandmother and my great-grandmother. Now, my grandmother I knew. My great-grandmother died a couple of years before I was born. But they're sitting on the couch laughing. My great-grandmother is just leaning back and laughing so loud. And my grandmother is sitting next to her, and she's got a laugh on her face. And I wonder, what was going on then? I'd like to know. I'd like to find out. God knows. And God could fill in all the details if it serves a purpose for him to do so and for me to know about that. My dad used to take some of the black and white photos, and he had some photo colors that he could use, some kind of a paint set, I guess, that you could paint on pictures with. And I have a picture of him, or excuse me, a picture that he had painted. It's of my sister. She's standing there. She has, in the picture, she has a nice yellow dress that my dad had painted on the picture. But on the back, it says Sharon. That was her name. Sharon in her new pink dress. So he maybe did know that it was pink, but he chose to make it yellow. So I only know what I see on the picture other than the caption that was written on the back. There are some other similar stories that came to mind as I was preparing this message. There was an article in the Minneapolis Star Tribune several months ago now. The title of it is "A Family's Treasured Photos Were Stolen. Can you help find them?" And the article reads, I'll read quite a few sections from this article because it helps make my point. It says, Tiffany Enriquez packed up the chapters of her family story, photo albums, wedding keepsakes, letters and journals, newspaper clippings about the father she lost when she was 8 years old, all tucked inside two black plastic milk crates for Sunday's move. They meant everything to the Enriquez family. They were worth nothing to the thief who stole them. And she goes on, she says, wedding album, family photo album, pretty much all my family's memorabilia, said Enriquez, who forgot to lock her car after she placed the two black plastic milk crates inside. When she came back to her vehicle in the Corcoran neighborhood in South Minneapolis, the crates and their cargo were gone. Well, she's hoping the thief might have dumped those two plastic crates somewhere and their treasures might be lying somewhere around town. And she's hoping someone will read these words and help bring them home. She goes on to say, there is nothing of value to the person who grabbed them. So I'm desperately hoping they were left in an alley or elsewhere to be found. Among the photos and albums were the papers of her late father, Carlos Enriquez, a student activist at the University of Minnesota who died in 1987. He was a former stonemason who died just as he was about to earn his degree at age 44. Tells a little bit more about them. Says his daughter had gathered the records of his years at the university, hoping to donate them to the school's Department of Chicano and Latino Studies. As she packed them up, she snapped a photo of one of the memorial letters. And as it turns out, that's the only record she has of what was in those crates. And in this memorial letter, it says, as Carlos Enriquez touched our lives, left us the better for the association, so his death touches us now and leaves a void, read one eulogy from the members of the Special Committee on Minority Programs, a void that may close somewhat with time, but one that can never be made completely whole. And now that letter is gone, along with baby photos, funeral cards, all the mementos of life in between. And she says she's kicking herself for forgetting to lock the car and so on. And then it goes on to say that if anyone knows anything about these, it gives the address of where it happened, and it gives an address, an email address where someone can contact the person who wrote this article. And I don't have any follow-up on that. I don't know whether any of them were returned or not, but these were just little things that described someone else in her life, and now that description is gone. She's one of these other people, just as those shown in the news reports. But God knows even more about this family and about the people in my own family photos and each of your own family photos than any of us do. He knows every person pictured, knows every detail about their lives. He knows when and where and why each photo was taken. He even knows about every incident that wasn't recorded. After all, photos can only record a very small fraction of anyone's life. Other records may include newspaper clippings or diaries, but these, again, are just physical records. They don't tell everything about a person, but God knows about them. He knows everything about them, everything about each of us as well. Now, from time to time, we may read about someone who tries to find descendants of a person in a photo, or the author of a diary or other object which contains enough information to track it down. I spend one afternoon a week at our local history center in Anoka. And for the, it was about a year ago, I guess, I was transcribing the diaries written by a 16-year-old local girl. They were written back in the 1890s, so 1890 roughly to, I think they go to 1904 or 5. And they're just ordinary letters. They describe the daily lives of her family, her relatives, and friends, give a good general representation of typical living at that time. This is all in her diary. She just records everything that was important that she could remember about the day. It gives a good general representation of typical living back then. And through her diaries, all these other people that she talks about now mean a little more to me because of my involvement with her diaries. Now, nearly every day, when the weather's decent, I do take exceptions when it's very snowy or rainy or icy or something, but otherwise, I take a nice walk every day. And I walk around part of the town for about an hour. Because I take the same route all the time, I've gotten to know quite a few people, quite a few dogs. I have a lot of dog friends that I've made. And that's very enjoyable, too. There's even one cat that's kind of friendly toward me. Cats are a little pickier, though, I don't know. But these walks take me to within half a block of where Alice Sterrett once lived with her family. I don't know if I gave her name, but Alice Sterrett is the person who wrote the diaries. And the house that she lived in, or her family lived in, along with several houses, other houses that you had known back at the time, are still standing. I walk by them. The current owners of that house are not related to her family. But the house is interesting because it used to stand a few blocks away, but there was a fire in Anoka back in 1884 that destroyed several other buildings. And for some reason or other, their old house was saved. And so they took it and moved it a few blocks away. They joined it up to another house that was already on another lot, and they just butted the two houses together. They were all two-story houses with a basement, so they dug a new foundation underneath it so that the basement would go through the whole building. And they butted up the first floor. It came pretty close. I've been in the house, and there's maybe a quarter-round difference between the floors on the first floor. When you go up to the second floor, though, there's a big step difference, so... And interesting, even though these houses put together are not very large by today's standards by any means, they have two stairwells going from basement to top on each side. There's certainly nothing you would add to a house like that, but it's interesting that it's there. I did, along with the director of our history center, director and I went over to visit that house. So that's when I saw the inside of it. And we brought her a copy of the journal that I had transcribed and gave it to them as a gift so they can read about someone else who used to live there. These diaries of her described day-to-day life at the time, talked about who they visited and who else was there and what they did. It talked about her father, Sam. He was struck by an artillery shell during the Civil War that eventually caused him to go blind. But before he was completely blind, he was still able to serve as the Anoka postmaster for 5 years. He died back in 1913. In her diaries, she describes what she calls the new high school, which was built in 1905. Well, that new high school that she talked about still stands there. It stands in the same place. It's been added on both sides, but the main building is still there. It's now a school administration building, but I went to junior high school there in that new school that she talks about. And my dad taught school there when we first moved to Anoka, so it has kind of a special meaning to it, too. And that school is about 4 blocks away from where her family lived and where her house is. The life she talks about at that time would have been very different from life today. The telephone had been invented, but it was not common in private homes until much later. She writes of going to, and I quote, she says that we went to Mr. Musseter's store to telephone to see if the train was on time. So telephones were available, not generally to the public yet. But instead of phoning, people visited others in person at others' homes. They gathered together at churches or community events. Selected groups might meet at what they called a sociable, where a group of people were invited to a gathering at someone's home or other location. And Alice mentions more than a dozen of these, making it sound like they were regular events rotating among several homes. So they wouldn't just call someone, they'd actually go to see them. They'd gather together and visit and talk to one another. So whenever I walk through that part of town, I feel like I'm drawn back in time. She and her family would have known some of the houses that still stand in that area. Some of these houses have historical signs on them that say when they were built. So there are houses from 1874, 1881, and 1867. They're all still standing. But these would all have been relatively new houses to Alice. She might have talked about, the new house one of these is built in 1881, a brand new house. I can hardly wait to see it. So she and her family and friends are more than just other people now. But, of course, I've never met her or anyone who knew or knew of her family. Despite reading about incidents of her daily life, I don't know her. She and all the others I read about or read about are still just other people to me. They're other people. I don't know anything about them, really, other than maybe I know a house that a certain family lived in. But at the same time, all of them are other people that God knows everything about. There's a website, I ran across this once when I was looking for something else. It was on www.upi.com, and it recounted how an old diary from 1938 was returned to the original owner's family. And this was printed on April 12th, 2022, so a couple years ago. Talks about a long-lost diary from 1938 returned to a Pennsylvania family. It says that a Pennsylvania woman whose grandson found a diary from 1938, more than two decades ago when this was written, said the book is on its way to being reunited with its original owner's family. Lisa Kuhlbau of Eaton Township said her grandson found a diary dated from 1938 in a bag of trash that had been thrown out after a house cleaning several years ago. I've had it for years. My grandson was only seven at the time, and he'll be 30 in August. So it had been around at least 23 years. Said that this lady recently posted about the diary, which belonged to a Donald D. Meeker. She posted it on Facebook, and a TV news report about the misplaced heirloom led to her being contacted by the Meeker's daughter-in-law. So it brought this lady into contact with another person strictly through this diary. I thought the daughter-in-law, Meeker's daughter-in-law, she said, "That's our pop-pop," said her daughter-in-law, identified as Mary Ann. Mary Ann said her late husband George was Donald D. Meeker's son, and she said the diary must have been thrown away accidentally while cleaning out a family member's house. We cleaned out the house on 44th, and apparently we were guilty of getting rid of this, which I feel very bad about. But it was meant to be, and we got it, and we retrieved it. So my daughter's going to treasure it with her two girls. So, and then it says that Kuhlbau and Mary Ann said they were surprised to learn that they have mutual friends, and they plan to keep in touch. So here's two kind of random families being brought together. They were random to each other, but not to God. God knew all about them, knew all about them. These were just other people until they made this connection. But they were never other people in God's eyes. So photos, diaries, journals, they can tell us quite a bit about other people and their lives, but they still remain other people to us. God knows, and he knows about every one of these other people. He has a plan that will eventually include every one of them. David understood some of this type of thinking in his Psalms. In Psalm chapter 40, verse 5, you don't need to turn there. I'll just read the verse, Psalm 40 and verse 5. "And your thoughts, which are toward us, cannot be recounted to you in order. If I would declare and speak of them, they are more than can be numbered." So they're just too much for a person to understand and comprehend the way God does and will. That was Psalm 40 and verse 5. We can try to comprehend the depth of God's understanding, and the appreciation of our lives and the lives of others, but we can't do so. In Psalm 40, further down in the chapter, David expresses this wonder and awe of God's presence in our lives. Psalm 40, verse 17, just one short verse. "But I am poor and needy, yet the Lord thinks upon me. You are my hope and my deliverer. Do not delay, O my God." So even someone who's poor and needy maybe feels very insignificant in this lifetime. Certainly not insignificant to God. The next thought I have is, how many people do we know? There are about 8 billion people living in the world today, and estimates are that about 117 billion people have ever been born on Earth. A New York Times article from 2013 estimates that the average American knows about 600 people. That's not very many. And I'll just read a couple paragraphs that tell how they came up with this. This is from a New York Times article from February 19, 2013. The article says the average American knows about 600 people. How do we know this? Researchers led by my Columbia colleague, Tian Zheng, posed a series of questions to a representative sample of 1,500 Americans. How many people do you know named Kevin? How many are named Karen? How many named Sean, various spellings of Sean, or Brenda, or Keith, or Rachel? Now, I would think that if we were to try to repeat this study, we might have to select names that are appropriate to our own time period. But the article says, after adjusting for various factors, for example, the names are not evenly distributed in age across the population, we determined that participants knew an average of 8.4 people with those names. Those names I mentioned, Sean, Karen, Brenda, Keith, and so on. Social Security records suggest that 1.4% of the population has one of the names, and 8.4 divided by 1.4% is 600 people. Now, I don't know how much faith to put in that, but an estimate of 600 people sounds kind of reasonable to me, just people that you could maybe point out by name or know something about. Still, out of 8 billion people on Earth today, 600 people isn't all that many. It would be fair to say that in round numbers, nearly all of the 8 billion people are unknown to us. They're just other people to us. But every one of them is known by God. Every one of them is one of God's other people. Does that make any of them less important to God? In his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, written by Dale Carnegie in 1936, at least I think that was the first edition of it. It's been reprinted many times, of course. He mentions that we need to remember that a person's name to him is the sweetest and most important sound in any language. And that's true. If you go up to a person and call them by name, it means much more than if you just go up and say, oh, hi, how are you, and then rush away. Many years ago, our church congregations were much larger. We had over, 300 people in the Minneapolis North congregation, and about 1,000 total among the Minneapolis North and Minneapolis South and St. Paul. So it was a pretty large crowd when we met for Holy Days, and I felt pretty much unknown by any of the ministers. Even back then, the ministers had large enough congregations that I just felt that they couldn't possibly know everyone in there. So I was especially pleased, even a little proud, when I said hi to Mr. Larry Walker. Remember Larry Walker? Several of you probably do. I had seen him at one of these holy days or maybe at a local service or something. And I just said hi to him when I passed him in the hall. And you know what he said? He said, hi, Dave, back to me. And that just lifted me up. It made me feel that, hey, I wasn't unknown. I meant something to him. And that meant a lot that he knew my name. But knowing someone's name is certainly important, but that doesn't mean you know the person. There are those who may brag that they know thousands of people by name. That doesn't mean that they truly know these people. But God does know, and he cares. And that's the third thought or point of this message. That is that God cares about everyone. In Luke 12, verses 6 and 7, Luke 12, 6, are not 5 sparrows sold for 2 copper coins? And not one of them is forgotten before God. But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear, therefore. You are of more value than many sparrows. I can't imagine how many hairs there are in this world, and to try to comprehend that God even knows every one of them, I don't know how that's going to work or what importance it will have, other than to indicate that God truly knows people. The Bible records the names of over 3,000 people in just the Old Testament. Now, names were sometimes more than an identity tag. A name sometimes revealed a person's character, personality, destiny. There are several biblical references to a new name signifying a new beginning, opportunity, or position. Remember, in Genesis 17, verses 5, 15, we see that Abram was renamed Abraham. Sarai, or however you pronounce that, Sarai maybe, was renamed Sarah. They were given new names. In Genesis 32, 28, Jacob, which from a definition I saw means the crafty one or the overreacher, was renamed Israel, one who has strived with God and prevailed. 1 John 1, verse 42, we see that Simon was renamed Peter. In Isaiah 62, verse 2, Jerusalem was given a new name. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, an article under names, says, "The Bible presents people not as a mass, nor as a fraction of a mass, or as cases to be studied, but as persons. The proper name in the Bible is the symbol of the person, and to address a person by name is to give to that person significance, meaning, dignity, and worth." And it does mean a lot to call people by name and to know their names. But still, even if we can call 1,000 people by name, that doesn't mean that we truly know them. Most of them are still other people in our lives, but they're not other people to God. I have one final story here to kind of sum things up. This was from an article by a person named Evan Ramstead. It was in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Sunday, May 7th, 2023, so about a year ago. And the title of that article was, "From St. Paul Plowing to Teacher Pay, Readers Debate My Columns." And this was someone's reaction to something that he had written in one of his columns. He said that, I guess his background here, there had been problems during snow plowing season in the winter when the cars were either plowed in against the curb or there was so much a plow drift that they couldn't find a spot to park. So this article now says, one reader called and told about getting his VW Beetle stuck in a rut on the unplowed Kellogg Boulevard in front of St. Paul City Hall in 1963. He was so livid, he decided to go inside and tell off the mayor. He was going to talk to the person in charge, and he was going to get something done. And the article says, seated at the reception desk in the mayor's office was a woman with whom he had gone to high school. He said he immediately felt foolish because he recognized he wasn't dealing with a faceless institution, but was dealing with someone just like him. He thought he was going to talk to some other person. That didn't mean anything to him, but this was a person with a face and a name and someone he had a tie connection with. So these other people that we read about or hear about are not nameless and faceless, But in many ways, they're people just like us. We individually or collectively may be just other people to the majority of people living in areas just around us. Most people around us wouldn't know any of us if they saw us on the street. For most of them, day-to-day life would continue just the same whether or not we were around. But there are no other people to God. God knows and has eventual plans for every one of them and every one of us.